My name is Jessica DeMotts, Jessica DeMotts. I'm interviewing Sheila Smith, Sheila Smith, in the McIntyre Library at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, on March 4th, 2010. So I'm just going to begin by asking some background questions. What was the date and place of your birth?
I was born in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, which is one of the closest outlying suburbs of North Minneapolis.
Okay.
In April 1957.
And how do you designate your race?
Caucasian.
And what about your ancestry or ethnicity?
It's kind of a mix of Irish, English, Norwegian, German. Those would be probably the biggest components.
And how many male or female siblings do you have?
I have 3 siblings, 1 older sister and 2 younger brothers.
And how is your relationship with them?
It's wonderful.
Wonderful?
Yeah.
Good. Are they in the area at all?
Well, they're reasonably close. My sister is in central Minnesota in a small town just south of Lake Mille Lacs. She lives a little bit out in the country. She's got 20 acres of land and a couple of big dogs and chickens, and she's an engineer. And I have she's older than myself. My next sibling is a brother who's about 2 years younger. He's a soil conservation land management specialist who lives outside of Duluth in a small Finnish town called Esko. And then the next brother comes in a few years later, and he's a social work professional in Duluth, Minnesota.
Cool. What was your birth order in your family?
I'm the second.
The second oldest?
Child.
Okay.
Yeah, second child. Yeah, my sister's 18 months older than I, so we sort of had a pretty, competitive approach to life in our childhood.
What is the name of your and occupation of your partner or spouse, if you have one?
Yeah, I'm married. My husband's name is Jim Rundle, and he teaches here at the university. He teaches in accounting.
And are you able to have much of a relationship with him on here on campus, being that you are in different departments?
We have actually served on some of the same committees, but other than that, our work lives don't cross much.
Okay. Do you wish that they would more, or do you like it?
I think we've got a pretty good balance, actually.
He's
very engaged with his department in college, and I'm very engaged with my department in college, and I frankly don't think there would be much time for either of us to have significantly more interaction at work. So.
Okay. How many children do you have, if any?
I have none of my own biologic children, but I have 2 stepsons through my marriage.
Okay.
They are both married and have, so I have 2 very wonderful daughters-in-law and 3 grandchildren. With a 4th on the way.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's fun.
Where did you attend school? What degrees have you earned? I know you have quite a few.
I started at the University of Minnesota. I actually never graduated from high school. I left high school after 11th grade. I couldn't manage there any longer. So I went directly to the University of Minnesota, and I studied there for 3 years. Without some direction, but not enough direction to know what I was really doing. It's an interesting story, actually. I don't know how much of this you want to go into, but it's sort of a fun personal story.
Whatever you want, you're welcome to share whatever you like.
Fun now, I guess it wasn't so fun at the time. When I went to college, I had in mind that I wanted to be a research ecologist. I had had a wonderful opportunity in high school as part of a enriched science biology course that I was in. It's a high school teacher that it was just probably very influential in many young people's lives in his career. And he, whenever possible, tried to make arrangements for students to be part of a National Science Foundation summer research program. So I got to do that during the summer after 11th grade. Went to University of Colorado in Boulder Mountain Research Station and spent a summer doing environmental ecological research in the mountains with graduate students from University of Colorado and staff members and faculty as well. So I was pretty determined that I was going to have a career as a environmental ecological research professional, and really had known, I think since about 7th grade, I think I knew that I was going to earn a PhD. And so this was sort of my planned route. But as a not yet high school graduate going to a university the size and complexity of the University of Minnesota, I kind of lost my way. There was absolutely no academic advising. And I think, I was pursuing biology courses, chemistry courses, math courses, German language courses, and music performance. I was a flutist at the time and had large amounts of credits in all of those areas that I could have gone any of those ways for a degree, and really had very little guidance along the way. So by the time I realized that if I wanted to do the work of an environmental ecological research person, what a PhD would entail, I was kind of lost. And so I had the thought of pursuing nursing, but at the time I was working with, I was working in the library. I had a job in the library, and some of the other student employees who were there were very discouraging to me about going into nursing. You know, why would you want to do that? It's such a dependent field. One of the young women who was a student research there was quite a feminist, and she just couldn't understand that interest of mine at all about going into nursing. But when I was in high school, I'd never known anyone in nursing. I shouldn't say that. In my own family, I hadn't known anyone in nursing. But in high school, a guy I was dating, and he and I were really quite close. His older sister was a nurse practitioner working in women's health, and his mother was a nursing faculty member working in pediatric nursing education. Those were the only two nurses I ever knew, and they were doing fascinating things. And as a younger person yet, I had had some pretty significant gender-sex trauma issues, and so to see people doing some very productive, helpful things for women's health and for children, I thought it sounded fabulous. But when I got to college and was interacting with other students, particularly in that job in the library, I was pretty strongly discouraged from pursuing that field, and I didn't quite get it. I didn't know enough about nursing to understand the dependent components, because the role models that I had seen were absolutely not in any kind of dependent positions. So anyway, that had happened, and after 3 years of studying all of these fields and really no specific direction, guy I was dating at the time was a relatively recently returned Vietnam vet and having some significant post-traumatic stress difficulties. He was very depressed, had several suicide attempts. The last of them was in my apartment when I was gone for the weekend, and I came home to find a really terrible mess. He did not die. He got himself to the hospital and did live. But at that point, I decided I needed a change in my life. My sister was living in Eau Claire, so I moved to Eau Claire, and after just a very short period of time, applied to the nursing program here and was admitted, and so that was the start of my career here in nursing. So my education began at the University of Minnesota. I finished my undergraduate degree in nursing here at UW-Eau Claire. Immediately applied to the master's program at UW-Eau Claire and finished that with a specialization as a clinical nurse specialist in medical surgical nursing, and then went on immediately to finish my PhD at the University of Minnesota, which took about 10 years. It was a long process. Following my PhD, then I continued on for nurse practitioner certification and finished that in 97. So my whole education probably spanned from about 1974 to 1996 for my whole college education. It's a long time. College, university. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So is there anything else you want to tell me about general background? I have more questions, but as far as...
I'll just go ahead and keep asking.
Okay.
If I want to add in more, I'll do that.
Okay. Describe your relationship with your parents. I know we talked a little bit about your siblings, if there's anything more you want to add about your siblings, but mainly your parents growing up.
Well, there were certain... It was a good relationship. We were a very fortunate family, I think. My father had some difficult aspects as far as getting along with him, but he influenced me greatly. He was a dentist and a very strong professional, very focused on the sciences, engineering, some of that kind of background, and very, very interested in the outdoors, natural environments. My mother was too. My mother, since the time I was quite small as I can remember, she would go on summer canoe trips up into Canada with women friends of hers with, you know, no provisions other than their food and tent and sleeping bags, and off into areas that were not marked as canoe routes, and they would just go and be gone. And she got us involved in lots of things. My mother was a professional musician. She played string bass, cello, and piano, and so that was kind of the music influence. So we had a lot of very enriching things in our family, and you know, some difficulties as well. But mostly it was a pretty enriched environment, I would say.
So was your mom went on trips quite often? Was your dad at home a lot, or was your mom mainly at home with you?
Our mother was mainly at home with us, yeah. My father's life was his work world, so his professional world, yeah. Although he did really devote, you know, he would very frequently take long weekends and devote that time to being together with all of us as a family, so yeah. Pretty traditional blend, though, of gender roles at our home, other than you know, these tendencies of my mother to go off and do very independent things, and my father was not at all resistant to that. Very supportive and encouraging of her doing those things.
Okay. And how about your siblings, your relationship with them?
You know, I think it was a good relationship overall. We were all, I think, quite independent youngsters. I don't know, I think we got along well.
Tell me about the community and the neighborhood where you grew up.
Yeah. Well, Robbinsdale is, like, as I mentioned, just the outskirts suburb, kind of the first ring community just north of Minneapolis. So Robbinsdale moves directly into North Minneapolis, and it had actually been a sort of a freestanding community until Minneapolis kind of expanded out that far. And so it had characteristics of, in some ways, kind of a small town freestanding community, but also of being, you know, a first ring suburb of Minneapolis. So kind of both. I would say it was primarily Caucasian, not much racial, ethnic diversity. Its history was very much kind of a working class, socioeconomically, but was starting to become much more middle class, I think, as I grew up in that time.
Okay. And what was the size of it? It was small, or?
Well, no, I wouldn't say. My high school, for instance, was probably 2,400 students, and there were several of them in the area, you know, so, no, it wasn't I think its history was as a smaller community, but not by the time I was growing up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Describe how your family was or was not connected to the community and neighborhood.
Well, we were very connected. The neighborhood kids were, you know, all family kids would get out together and be out in the neighborhood every night, and there was a couple of open lots in the neighborhood that we'd go and, you know, play out in the field and played baseball and stuff out in the fields, and all the neighborhood kids would play together. Our family of four kids was one of the smallest families of the block. There were several Catholic families living nearby, and they were 9 to 11 kids. I think there was one family that had three kids, so they were probably the smallest family. And then a couple of families of older adults. So there was a lot of interaction and activity among the residents of the neighborhood. We knew each other well enough that we would, you know, just go knock on the door and go in and sit and spend hours. So families would feed other kids when they came by, all that kind of thing, you know. As far as connection within the community itself, most of that probably was through school. My family did attend a church for a while, but that was actually in another one of the communities a little ways further distant, and then we didn't stay with that real long, so yeah.
Who had power and privilege in your community, and how did that affect you and your family?
Well, power and privilege was primarily socioeconomic, my family was definitely one of those that that had privilege. I don't know that I had a sense that there was a power differential so much, but there was definitely a privilege differential, and we were definitely you know, quite well privileged. But I guess I don't really have a clear sense of exactly how that compared with some of the other families. I think because we had fewer children to feed and support, probably we did have a little bit more resources than some of the surrounding families had. Yeah.
What values did you learn from your family and other people in institutions in the community?
Values, well, let's see. Definitely values of work ethic, strong work ethic, accountability for one's actions, looking out for others, taking care of others. I think those are probably some of the primary a sense of integrity, a strong sense of integrity. I think that definitely came from my father. It was just very, very important to him. Honesty, truthfulness, living up to expectations that others have of one.
Mm-hmm. What lessons did you learn from each of your parents?
Well, I think from my father, I learned the value of hard work and commitment. He was
absolutely committed to all of us. Always put other people first. Always put other people first. So that was, I think, a real important lesson. I think another value from him is the value of scientific data, of scientific evidence, of but blending that with a true love of the natural world.
What role did education play in your life?
Huge, huge, huge. Education saved my life. Saved my life. So it was a huge role. I had had some pretty tough experiences in my early teen years relating to really sexual abuse, gender discrimination kinds of things, and having academics to turn to really kind of saved my life.
Did you enjoy school?
I loved it.
All throughout?
Well, except by the time I got to, you know, kind of that 12th grade time period and felt like I needed to move on. Mm-hmm. But once I got into the university environment, I just, again, was loving it.
Give an example of how gender, race, ethnicity, and social class were important in building your understandings of yourself and mm-hmm. society.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first that I can truly remember was probably goes back to about fourth or fifth grade. Physically matured probably earlier than some of the other girls in my class, and a lot of unwanted attention came to me as a result of that. So I think I was starting to experience some of the unfortunate aspects of sexualization as young as fourth and fifth grade. I remember very distinctly a sixth grade teacher kind of singling me out as someone who was a quote-unquote troublemaker, and I think it had to do with simply being somewhat more mature physically than many of the other girls in the class. He was very into chess and math and would take extra time after school with some of the boys, with teaching them chess and doing chess competitions and helping them with math. And I distinctly remember having wanted to be a part of that and not being allowed to be. And I was very aware that it was because I was a girl that those things were happening. In seventh grade social studies, we had an assignment of exploring a career that we wanted to pursue, and I chose marine biologist. We had to stand up in front of the room and talk about it, and my social studies teacher, who was a man, it's hard to gauge age when you're that, you know, when you're that young, but I imagine he was probably in his early 50s, gave my report on being a marine biologist, and he laughed out loud in front of the class. Also in that year, though, I had a home economics teacher. All of us girls had to take home economics in those days, cooking and sewing and that kind of thing. But my home economics teacher had a PhD and insisted that we call her by her appropriate academic title, her Dr. Koivisto. She was the only teacher in the entire junior high who had a PhD. So that was really where the idea, I think, came to me that I'm going to do that. I'm going to have a PhD. Just no question about it. I made up my mind at that point. So there were some very early, very, very early influences. And then, as I mentioned, the some abusive experiences too, and they actually occurred in eighth grade. So and that was very traumatizing to me. So lots of things that made me very aware from quite a young age that there were some significant real dangers, as well as lots of obstacles associated with growing up female.
How about with race? I know you said you didn't have much diversity.
No, and we really didn't even, you know, even in school, there was really not much diversity. I could probably count on, you know, two hands the number of kids from non-Caucasian backgrounds. You know, we had a few kids from Asian background, few African American, and some Native American. My best friend actually was a Native American girl. We were very close for a long time. So through her family, I got introduced to some Native American aspects of heritage, although I would say that I guess I don't really know to what extent her family might have been involved in any actual traditional practices. None of that was anything that I saw, but we did get to go up to, I went with her and her family to some Native American community, more residential community kinds of activities, through a summer cottage that her family had in the Lake Mille Lacs area. So there was some exposure, but pretty minimal.
Okay.
Always, though, just tremendous acceptance of racial ethnic differences. There was not a sense in my mind that there would have been active discrimination, I don't think.
What did you learn from experiencing or witnessing any acts of discrimination gender-wise?
Well, I think I've shared quite a bit of that already. So yeah, I saw a lot of that in a very direct way.
Okay. Describe any efforts you witnessed or participated in confronting discrimination.
Well, I think when I had my own issues and difficulties, and they were significant, my father came immediately to my assistance and literally saved my life. So, and of course my mother was part of that too, but it was, I think, really my father who stepped up and took the steps that were needed to assist me very, very directly. And so that was a very personal kind of confrontation, if you will, but it was certainly very direct and very, very instrumental in helping me continue with any kind of young adult development.
Mm-hmm. What memories from your childhood continue to make a difference on your life today?
Well, mostly the good things. Mostly the good things. My family was able to do a lot together with camping kinds of activities and being together out kind of in non-developed areas, and that just shaped my life in major, major ways. The strengths that I learned relative to education and academics and developing myself personally has certainly stayed with me.
Okay.
And I think as well, it took me a long time emotionally to get through the trauma that occurred to me. But that's certainly been pretty fully integrated now in my sense of who I am.
What significant historical events do you recall most clearly from your childhood, and how have they affected you throughout your lifetime?
Yeah, well, certainly John F. Kennedy's assassination was a huge event. The race unrest, the race riots, that all was quite visible in the Minneapolis area while I was growing up, and a lot of that was occurring, you know, kind of right in that North Minneapolis community that my community was just adjacent to. So that was very, very significant. The Vietnam War, I was one of the younger kids in the neighborhood. The families that have had those large numbers of children, many of those children were quite a bit older than me, so that they were already graduating from high school when I was, you know, kind of moving into junior high age, and they were being drafted and sent to Vietnam. So I was pretty involved in even sixth grade. We were involved in some Vietnam protest activities in our own neighborhood. That some of the older kids, the siblings of those who were being drafted, were pretty instrumentally involved in. So historically, those things were very influential. Nixon's resignation, I remember very, very clearly. A lot of drugs. There were a lot of drugs in my high school. I remember kids who wrecked their brains on serious drug use.
Looking back on your childhood, would you have anticipated that you would become a feminist later in life?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was a pretty committed feminist by the time I came back from that summer National Science Foundation project.
What else would you like to share about your childhood experience? Anything?
Well, that's probably enough about my childhood.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know you described both your educational path after high school, but what about after college?
Well, it's ongoing. It just never ends. You know, as an academic, it never ends. Mm-hmm. Also, in my professional life, I'm a nurse practitioner, so I'm always involved in continuing education. The kind of teaching that I do with nursing students, I teach at both the undergraduate and the graduate level with nurse practitioner students, and so it's pretty complex content that I'm teaching, and every time I teach it, it's changed because healthcare keeps changing. So it's just imperative that I be constantly continuing to educate myself. Women's studies and feminism as well. Feminist theory has evolved dramatically, so that's an interesting aspect to try to keep up with also. So it just never ends. It's continuous. Yeah.
When and how were you awakened to social inequalities based on gender, race, social class, sexual orientation, and other layers of identity?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, I think a pretty young age, I was pretty keenly aware of it by the time I was finishing high school and moving into college.
Okay.
So that I could articulate. So that I really could articulate what the disparities were and the discrepancies were.
What memories do you have of your first encounters with a feminist or the subject of feminism?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say my first encounters with feminism, let's see. Actual memories of that. I would say it was probably the first person who I knew who actually called themselves a feminist was the work-study student that I worked with in the library at the University of Minnesota, who was discouraging me from going into nursing. She was the first one who I knew actually used the word feminist to describe herself. But I'm very sure that many of the other women who had been influential in my life were feminist, had probably just not used that word.
What resistance, if any, did you face from people you cared about when you became a feminist or decided that you wanted to do feminist work?
Very little.
Very little?
No. Mm-mm. I don't recall any specific resistance. Yeah. Yeah.
Describe the process you went through as you were deciding to identify as a feminist.
Well, it's a very long process, I guess. All of those early things were very, very influential. And as I mentioned, I think, you know, by the time I was ready to be done with high school and moving into college, I was a very independent individual. And, there weren't very many people who could tell me what to do or how to do it. So I think I already very much, you know, kind of saw myself in a very independent light. When I started taking courses here at the University of Minnesota, University of Wisconsin Eau Claire, one of the first courses I took was Carol Fairbanks' Women in Literature course, and so that was probably a first sort of formal experience of exploring ideas about women in particular. She didn't teach that course at the time from an openly articulated feminist theory point of view, but she was clearly bringing feminist interpretations into the things that we read, and it was very much those feminist interpretations that she was helping us to appreciate as a class that opened my eyes in a pretty significant way to a whole nother realm of perspectives and way of interpreting, and the power of that, the cognitive power of what that could mean and how it can change the way you see the whole world. So that was a significant moment. And then I also took Helen Minkus's class on women in anthropological perspectives. I can't quite remember if that's the correct title. I think it might be. But that as well was very eye-opening to really look at the world from an interpretive perspective that used a womanist lens. I wouldn't call it exactly a feminist lens at that particular time, because I don't believe they were presenting it that way. Or if they were, it was a little bit softened, but it was definitely a womanist lens, and that was quite eye-opening.
What to you is the difference between womanist and feminist?
Well, I see feminist as very much a political perspective. A feminist perspective is one that looks very much at the disparities in women's lives and makes active attempts to address some of that. Whereas I think a womanist perspective might be one that would recognize that there is a very identifiable difference between sort of the dominant patterns of how men view and interact with and interpret the world as compared to how women might, and of course mostly what we hear is the androcentric view. So it was a a new and unique experience to me to focus from a perspective on of women's lives.
Feminism has been described as a river with many tributaries. In other words, although feminists are united by some common beliefs, they understand and express those beliefs differently. How do you describe the tributary of feminism and that best fits your beliefs?
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate the aspects of feminism that that look at multiple sources of disparity and discrimination, so that look at race, class, gender, sexual orientation, ableism, age, socioeconomics, you know, really try to look at the intersection of multiple forms of discrimination. I think that's just been a tremendously valuable contribution that that feminism has made. And I really think that some of those perspectives may have, the perspectives of integrating multiple forms of discrimination may have come first, or early on anyway, I don't know about first, but early on from feminist thinkers. And the value of that in terms of being able to bring a unified approach to social activism is just, I think, a phenomenal thing. So it's a tremendously important contribution.
What meaning does the feminist statement, "the personal is political," hold for you?
Well, it just is, it's just a truism. It's a truism from my own life. It's a truism when, I think when one looks at the lives of women from a, you know, sort of macro social perspective, one's, you know, politics become meaningful and alive when there are specific personal connections that one can make from, if not one's very own life, then the lives of those that they see around them. And so the extent to which personal challenges, difficulties can become a way of shaping a political perspective just becomes a very powerful source of belief, of framing perspectives, of taking action, of commitment.
How do you define power?
Power. Well, there are lots of different ways to define power. There's certainly power over, there's power with. The power over perspective is probably the way dominant culture approaches have functioned. And that leaves lots of people out and creates lots of hierarchy and lots of disparity. And so the empowerment perspective, the power with perspective, really helps to bring lots more people into the picture. Lots more participation, lots more involvement, and really broadens that circle of who gets to participate. So my preferred definition would be a power with. I think it's pretty clear that the world doesn't yet operate that way. So I think it's important to understand both aspects and to be able to evaluate which is occurring and adapt.
How have you negotiated and balanced your identity as a feminist with constraining cultural expectations for femininity or masculinity?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I think, you know, some individuals would possibly look at my professional background in nursing as a way that conforms to social expectations for women. But, you know, my PhD work in that was with women who'd experienced developmental harmful experiences of sexualization and how that influenced their lives. So while in one way I've, you know, sort of conformed in a sense through my career path, it's also been an avenue within that career path that's opened up whole new areas of study in nursing and in health. So, I don't mean that my work individually has opened that up, but it's been part of a process of opening up whole new areas of study. So there's been a mix, you know, there's been a real mix, and I'm happy, I think, with the way that balance has come out.
What have been the greatest challenges you have faced as a feminist?
Working in nursing and healthcare, there are some significant challenges relative to feminism, and particularly in the field of nursing. Nurse-physician relationships, I think, continue to be a fairly significant challenge. And also within the discipline of nursing, I think there's possibly a less well-developed understanding of feminist theory than I would like to see. And maybe that's the case in most fields where a feminist perspective on a particular field is sort of a subspecialty area. So it might not be that it's unique in nursing, but it is a challenge, I think. One of the wonderful things about a career as a nurse and also in academic nursing is that I'm working very, very directly with women colleagues, and that is a wonderful thing. But the extent to which feminism can be, and feminist theory, feminist research can be a shared focus is sometimes a little bit limiting.
Which of your contributions have made the greatest difference in shaping feminist theories and practices and your own understandings of yourself as a feminist?
Well, a couple of different areas, I think. I've been pretty involved here helping to develop the women's studies curriculum with the intro to women's studies courses, the 301 course, the 490 course when that was first developed. So that feels like a pretty significant contribution, just in terms of being part of the work of building and shaping a whole curriculum here on a college campus. So there's that component. And then within nursing, some of my research has looked at specifically at women's experiences with victimizing sexualization. So that was kind of a new avenue to bring to the field of nursing research, nursing scholarship. So that was a nice contribution to be able to make as well.
What do you consider the greatest achievements of feminism over the past 25 years?
Oh, changing the lives of women. Making it possible for young women to open their lives and make choices and pursue their interests and do that in ways that have real opportunities for them. That's been the biggest thing. And on a global basis, women's lives have changed. Women's lives have changed dramatically. I mean, there still certainly are areas where women live in terrible conditions and face terrible obstacles, but the amount of change that has occurred is really just world-changing.
What do you think are the most important challenges feminism must overcome in this century?
The challenges for feminism to overcome, I'm not quite sure. You know, you could interpret that question a couple of different ways. If feminism were the sort of the social movement responsible solely for changing the world, then there's, you know, there's still lots and lots and lots that needs to be overcome. Lots of socioeconomic disparities, lots of political inequities, access to resources, all kinds of those kinds of issues still exist. Feminism doesn't do that work by itself, and so working in conjunction with other movements and political initiatives working toward social justice, equity, social change, that's certainly probably the biggest difficulties for feminism to overcome. In terms of difficulties within feminism that need to be overcome, I think one of the biggest barriers is you know, sort of the bad press that feminism gets, and misinterpretations. A lot of that is fear, I think. Fear of change, fear that people might have to give up certain things, certain comforts, certain privileges, if they were to fully embrace a feminist world.
Have you ever experienced that fear?
No. No, I don't have that fear. And, you know, partly that might be the privilege I enjoy in my own life. You know, I've got a career, I've got an income, I've got a stable family, I've got a stable place to live. All those things make it possible to live without having to deal with those worries, I think.
When you think about your life experiences, what coming-of-age stories come to mind?
Well, I guess I've probably told as much of them as I probably can at this point.
So, okay.
Yeah.
To what extent did your gender, race, social class, sexuality, and family situation influence your coming-of-age experiences, and what ways made sense of them? And what ways did you make sense of them?
Yeah. Well, let me go back to the first question you asked, because I think, you know, my main coming-of-age story was probably the abuse that I experienced, and so making sense of it had to do with my family's support, particularly my father's support. But then going on from there, making sense of it by choosing to leave the high school environment and get into what felt like a more productive space. And that stayed with me in terms of then pursuing women's studies and feminist theory as my PhD minor and my whole dissertation area. So, you know, it stayed with me for a long time in terms of working to make sense of those experiences.
In what ways were these coming of age stories personally transformative for you?
Wow, these are big questions. I think through the process of my own research and processing my own experiences, I became a different person. I completely became a different person and a different view of the world that by developing a politicized understanding of what it was that happened not only to myself but lots and lots of women on an everyday basis. I was able to understand my own experience in very different ways and realize that there was, you know, lots of work to do to help change the world. So it's become part of my own personal commitment.
What, if any, celebrations or public events figured significantly a part of these experiences?
I don't know if that really applies. Yeah, I can't really think of how it would.
Okay. What, if any, personal losses result from these experiences?
Oh, lots of losses. Lots of losses along the way. And, you know, but everyone has losses in their life, and you integrate them. And my grandmother always used to say, you know, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, so.
Okay.
And I think in my case, I did derive strength out of processing, working through events. Yeah.
Okay. What social scripts influenced the type of coming of age experiences you sought and found?
Can you help me understand that a little better?
Okay. So maybe the better one, the second one. What about what is going on politically and socially at the time of your coming of age experiences? That might be a better one for you than the other one. I don't know.
Well, I think I talked about that a little bit already. There was a lot of feminist activity occurring during the years that I was, you know, kind of moving from high school into college. I have a cousin who was very involved with New York City feminists at that time. She's a writer and was very involved in lesbian feminist communities in New York City. And I was aware of her life. I wasn't real aware of the details of her life, but enough to know that a cousin of mine was out there making a living as a writer and living with a community of women who were very strong activist women and part of the whole feminist movement. Another cousin who pursued a career as a physician, and one who pursued a career as a dentist, and you know, women cousins. And even before that, my grandmother, who was born before the turn of the century, she was born in 1890, and she was the second oldest of 12 kids near Bemidji. Their family had homesteaded a farm where they had to, you know, clear the land and pull the roots out of the ground using horse and plow. And so as the oldest of 12 kids, she had a lot of responsibility in that family. She wanted to go to teacher's school, which was normal school at the time, came after finishing high school. The closest normal school was in town in Bemidji, and her family was far enough out of town that she couldn't have made the trip on a daily basis, and the family couldn't afford for her to take one of the horses to ride in on a daily basis. So she had to leave the family home and move into town and rent a room in order to go to normal school. And at the time that school started, they hadn't yet gotten the harvest in for the year. Potatoes were still in the ground. So she was told by her father that if she left home and went to school, that she should not plan to come back. And she did that. She left home and went into town and went to school and became a teacher. And so, you know, I think there were lots of influences very, very early on, in my earliest memories of seeing strong women do independent things. None of the women cousins in my family ever changed their names when they got married. We all kept our family of origin names on getting married. So there were, I think, you know, some patterns I was seeing around me that were very, very supportive of women being pretty independent in their lives. So those were some social scripts. They were personalized social scripts, but they were very influential.
Given what you know now, how would you like to rewrite or reframe your coming of age experiences?
I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't. I don't know. Because I don't know what it would be if it were different. And so there were some difficulties. There were some significant difficulties. I don't think I would ask for it to be different.
How long and what have you been engaged with at the UW-Eau Claire Women's Program?
Well, I came here in 81. '89, I believe, was when I started teaching here at UW-Eau Claire. And the very first thing I taught was a women's health issues course. And within a very short time, I was working with some other wonderful women on campus doing some of the developmental work for some of the first intro women's studies courses. So I worked with Margaret Cassidy and Jane Peterson and Jan Bogstad, and the four of us developed the very first intro women's studies course. And Jan and I then worked on the 490 course.
Okay.
That's been an important part of my work here for a long time.
Okay. Was that the first memory of the program, or what was?
No, I took courses here that were women's studies courses. And I don't even know at the time I was a student here if there was an organized women's studies minor. I don't believe there was. I think they were just sort of scattered women's studies. I'm not sure about that. Maybe someone could look back and find out, you know, when did the women's studies minor actually get established. Yeah, I don't think that was yet in existence when I was taking those courses. I can't remember who was the coordinator of the Women's Studies program at that time, if there even was a coordinator. When I first came in 89, Sarah Harder was the coordinator, and she, of course, was a very prominent activist. So she was a feminist activist in the very traditional sense of what that meant, and was just a fabulous mentor and role model. So.
Okay. How has the program changed during the time that you haven't been involved with it?
Oh, it's grown dramatically. The curriculum has expanded. The academic distinction of the program has really, you know, come of age. There's the integration of theory and scholarship has really evolved. So it's really become a solid scholarly program over the last 20-some years.
What are the major contributions of the UW-Eau Claire Women's Program to the campus, community, and beyond?
Well, it's of course a very strong interdisciplinary program, so it's made a major contribution in terms of interdisciplinary offerings and activities on campus. It's certainly been centrally involved with diversity initiatives on campus. The whole perspective on social justice, equity, social determinants of people's lives has been strongly, I think, shaped and supported through women's studies programming. There are other programs that do some of that work as well, but women's studies has made a big contribution to that area.
Okay. Share any stories of people or events that you think are significant in shaping the 25-year history of women's studies at UW-Eau Claire.
Oh gosh, there have been so many people. You know, Sarah Harder's work, I think, was phenomenal. But going back before that, those faculty members who were real pioneers in teaching some of this content in the earlier days, it's just such a wonderful starting place. I wish I knew more about the details of that than I do, but there were some individuals who committed their careers to what was probably seen as somewhat archaic content, with you know, Helene Minkus's work and Carol Fairbanks, Rita Gross in philosophy, religious studies. And then there was a small circle of faculty who took the content area very, very seriously in the early 1990s and devoted a lot of time. And several of those I've mentioned, Margaret Cassidy, Jane Peterson, Jan Bogstad, and Sarah Harder was instrumental in, you know, really seeing that work through. I can't remember quite when Catherine Rhodes came to campus, but she just brought a level of energy and enthusiasm that was just contagious, which I think she brings to everything she does. And so that helped to energize people and sort of spirit things along. So I don't know if those stories are helpful or not. But
yes, definitely. What would you consider your major contribution to the success of the program?
I think some of the early curriculum work. You know, and I was trying to think earlier about when did we have a minor. I think we did that work. I think that was Jane, Margaret, Jan, Sarah, myself, Duffy, Bernard Duffhausen helped quite a lot. He was chair of the English department at the time, and he was very supportive. Carl Haywood, I believe, was dean of arts and sciences at the time, and I think it was at that time that we brought in the women's studies prefix and developed the minor. Now, that historically probably needs to be checked, but if my memory serves right, I believe that might have occurred in the early 1990s, and I think that's one of the things that I feel best about having contributed to in those early days, the courses that we developed to establish that, and kind of the sequence of courses. And, yeah.
What would you like your legacy to be in the Women's Studies program?
Gosh, I don't know. That I was able to be part of the development of a wonderful academic program.
As you think about the future, what role do you think the Women's Studies will play on the UW-Eau Claire campus, community, and beyond?
Well, I think Women's Studies will continue to be a source of leadership for thinking about important social questions, diversity issues, diversity initiatives, issues of social justice, issues of equity, and really bringing some resources to the lives of women students that otherwise simply would not be. So so I'm very hopeful that women's studies will continue to serve that role. Fits wonderfully well with strategic initiatives of campus and the vision and mission, so